Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio productions from this and many other independent community stations across the country. We bring local stories to a national audience from a different location every week. I'm Dori Smith of Talk Nation Radio Studios in Storrs, Connecticut. The music of Echo Uganda, performing live in Boston. The musical group has toured with peace groups, raising money, and seeking to bring about an end to violence in Africa. But do Americans still have the heart and the interest to participate in fundraising efforts for peace during hard economic times? Our guest, Dan Wolf, has found a myriad of ways to offer what he calls sustainable humanitarian aid for Sudan and other parts of Africa.
At current rates of deforestation, those countries will have been almost completely deforested and will look something like Haiti.
Today on Sprouts, Washington lawyer and philanthropist Dan Wolf shares his story as founder of Lifeline International, an aid organization he founded with some of the $95 million he won in a lawsuit against Saddam Hussein on behalf of Americans taken hostage after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. That was 19 years ago in August of 1990. Today, Lifeline International aids refugees in camps in Darfur, Sudan, northern Uganda, the Somali border of Kenya, and the Burundi's border of Tanzania. And as you will hear, the group focuses on bringing about an end to the defoliation and toxic smoke caused by heavy burning of the region's wood. Dan Wolf, welcome.
Thank you.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about how you started all of this work?
I was attorney in private practice, had spent many years doing refugee and human rights work, and in 2003 was fortunate enough to do very well on one of my lawsuits, a multi-plaintiff lawsuit against the Iraqi government for taking American citizens hostage during the first Gulf War. And as a result of having prevailed in that case, I collected enough in fees to be able to begin my own foundation.
And what got you interested in Sudan?
I was interested in Africa. I had spent a lot of time, as I said, doing human rights and refugee work and had been on a number of missions in Southeast Asia. I had been to Albania and to Kosovo on behalf of an organization called Refugees International. But having gone to those places, one thing that I had learned is that as dire as the situations were in those refugee camps I had visited, the situation was much worse in camps in Africa where people did not even have the bare essentials of life, food or water. And I knew also based on my travels that the amount of money that would be needed to uplift people in Africa was even a lot less than what would be needed in Southeast Asia where I'd done most of my work.
Dan Wolf, I understand too that you have a background in government work, legal expertise in government work. What is the circumstance that you find yourself in now that you're focusing on Sudan when it comes to all of the background politics that so affect the situation for people, you know, displaced people?
I try and ignore that now because when we have programs on the ground with individuals working in a somewhat dangerous environment and where we're trying to get cooperation from the government to allow us to operate, because international NGOs can only operate at the pleasure of the Sudanese government, we really try and stay away from political and legal issues, the kind of thing that I had been involved in for most of my career until now, insofar as my humanitarian work is concerned. And I should mention that we had to suspend our operation in Sudan about a year ago because of the difficulties of access to the camps that house internally displaced people in that country. And as a result, we focused our attention now in Kenya on the Somali border, where we're working with Somali and Sudanese refugees in northern Uganda and in Tanzania along the Congolese border.
Why don't you explain a little bit about why you focus on sustainable humanitarian aid work as
right.
opposed
to this project, having been funded by myself, I really wanted to make every dollar count and have it go as far as humanly possible. And too frequently in humanitarian settings, a dependency mentality is created, especially almost by necessity in refugee camps and camps for internally displaced persons. This dependency mentality is created by the interventions that are intended to help people. And so frequently you're doing an aid program and people are just waiting for what they're going to get next. So not only the programs are not self-sustaining, they actually encourage a more dependent mentality in which people are simply waiting for the next aid. And we wanted to help to break that cycle by providing aid, but providing it in a way that would help uplift people out of poverty, feeling that that would be the best way, obviously, to have the greatest impact over time. And to that end, we have been focused on something that is only now beginning to receive a lot of attention due to the environmental crisis, and that is sustainable fuel technologies for vulnerable and impoverished peoples in Africa. And really, that focuses on providing people an alternative to cooking on an open fire in order to sustain themselves.
Now, we've heard a lot about the problem of deforestation in Africa. Why don't you explain the conditions in the region where you're working and why this is so important in particular there?
In two of the regions where we've worked, Sudan and Uganda, those countries have lost literally 30% of their forest cover since 1990. Their populations are doubling every 30 years. And so in approximately 30 years from now, at current rates of deforestation, those countries will have been almost completely deforested and will look something like Haiti. Right now, as a result of the movement of the Sahara to the south and the growing population in Darfur, there has been a huge resource problem. And that resource problem is really what lies at the heart of the conflict in Darfur. Basically, you're having a tension that's been exploited by the government between sedentary farming communities and nomadic communities competing for scarce arable land. And that is what has fed the violence in that country. As this kind of resource issue spreads throughout Africa, with the existing tensions, tribal tensions that already exist in many parts of the continent, essentially what you're seeing in Darfur will just be the beginning of a cataclysm of violence throughout Africa, which will diminish the resources of the world, occupy the world's attention, and create insecurity problems for everyone. In dealing with this, we're not just dealing with an African problem, we're not just dealing with a humanitarian problem, we're dealing with a global problem.
And talk a little bit more about how your effort, Lifeline, works with people who are actually having to live as displaced people. What's it like for them to receive your help? And what do you hope to accomplish with individuals in this part of the world?
First of all, I should mention that we deal with displaced people, but we also deal with vulnerable peoples who have recently returned to their communities. That's mainly in Uganda. So we're dealing with people who are living on the margins of human existence. And this fuel-efficient stove that we're promoting is really a profound and life-transforming intervention for the beneficiaries. They have typically, are cooking on an open fire with wood, which means that, especially in a place like Darfur or in the Somali border of Kenya, where the areas have already been substantially deforested, that means they're spending maybe 5-6 hours a day collecting wood. Even in an area that is more forested, like in Uganda, they may be spending 2 or 3 hours a day collecting wood. They're spending another 3 hours a day cooking. So it's occupying all of their time, diverting attention from caring for children or for engaging in other kinds of income-generating activities. Cooking on open fire also means being inside a hut, breathing in noxious fumes. If you were to go into one of those huts in a refugee camp or in a small village and somebody was cooking, you would last for about a minute before your eyes would be tearing, you'd be coughing, and you couldn't possibly imagine how somebody could cook there for a half hour, an hour. Well, if you breathe in those fumes day in and day out for your life, it's going to create an enormous health hazard, which it does. The indoor air pollutants are the fourth number one killer in Africa. You have a lot of kids who've sustained burn injuries. You have people who, when they are collecting wood, are vulnerable to rape and other forms of sexual abuse or violence. And so this kind of intervention, which is a very inexpensive intervention, could cost as low as $2 or $3 per stove, which is caring for a whole family, really transforms life in a multitude of ways for people.
explain what this magic stove is. What does it run on?
Right. Well, the stove that we are presently promoting actually does run on wood or charcoal, but it runs on far less wood or charcoal than an open fire. Essentially, it is made of clay and other readily available organic material that burns, be it donkey dung or rice husk or groundnut shells. And what you do is we mix those two products together, the clay and the organic material, and we form a trapezoidal-shaped brick that we then burn in the kiln. And when we have rice husk available, we can use a woodless kiln, so we don't use any wood to burn the bricks. When the bricks burn, the organic material burns away. And as a result, it leaves small air pockets, and you end up creating an insulated combustion chamber out of six bricks, which increases the efficiency of the burn. At the same time, the stove is proportioned to increase the heat transfer to the pot, and as a result, you minimize the use of wood by as much as 50% if people are using it correctly.
How does Lifeline plan to get these into the hands of people? What actually is the process here?
Well, if we are in a refugee camp or what's called an IDP camp, a camp for people who are internally displaced within their own country, then essentially what we do is we create a workforce within the camp among the population who will assist us in producing the stoves right on site. And we will also train people how to use those stoves, and they will be our training force, and they will then train beneficiaries from various populations within the camp who come in and learn how to use them and receive their stove and bring them home to their hut. In a more stable population in northern Uganda, what we've done is rather than just give stoves away, we've created and are trying to create a cottage industry in which we employ people to manufacture the stoves in a kind of factory or production center that's right in the town, some remote town. And then we train a sales force of female micro entrepreneurs to sell the stoves. So we create a kind of win-win-win environment where our organization is winning because we're producing a product that makes a big difference in people's lives. We employ people who win because they are gaining their livelihood. We have empowered many women who now have their own independent livelihoods as well as sellers. And, of course, most importantly, we are benefiting the end users, and everybody profits except for us financially in the process. So that is a truly sustainable solution.
Explain why the use of these stoves can reduce the kinds of adverse effects on the air quality in the whole region that are of such concern to the whole world today.
Well, two reasons. One is simply the deforestation that's caused, as I mentioned before, by the use of wood for cooking. As I had mentioned, one-third of the forest cover in Uganda and Darfur has been lost. Half of that, literally half of that, is a result of using wood for cooking. So if we can reduce that amount, we're going to have a substantially beneficial effect on reducing the rate of deforestation. If we can combine that with a tree planting program, maybe we can start turning things around. Secondly, recent studies have shown that the emissions, believe it or not, from these open fire cooking methods release black soot into the environment, and that this black soot, which stays in the atmosphere, actually contributes on a short-term level to as much as 18% of global warming. And that black soot doesn't stay nearly as long as the CO2 emissions that are believed to be the most significant cause of global warming. So we can have a rather immediate impact by reducing the amount of black soot that is emitted.
The website is lifelinefund.org. Is there a picture on your website of this biomass cooking stove?
There are plenty of pictures on the website of the stove. And we are also working with other organizations that are trying to develop stoves that are based purely on non-wood biomass. Those are a little bit more tricky to use and a little bit more costly. But if we can eventually integrate those into our program and get those out through Africa, eventually maybe we can make cooking with wood obsolete.
You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Dori Smith of Talk Nation Radio, also syndicated with Pacifica Network. We're speaking with Washington lawyer Dan Wolf, president of the George Wolf Operating Foundation and founder of Lifeline International. He has taken fact-finding missions to Sudan with Refugees International, and he works in the region helping displaced people learn more sustainable ways of heating and cooking food and obtaining clean drinking water. To get a sense of the scale of this problem, we went to Bioenergy Lists to look at the section on biomass cooking stoves. The creation of charcoal also contributes to deforestation in Africa and sickens, particularly the children. Documentary filmmaker Bruno Tori illustrated the painful journey of one charcoal seller who rides 80 kilometers to sell coal he can fit on top of his bike. And it's a vicious circle. The coal he may sell for a few dollars makes it possible for him to take his sick children to the doctor, but it may well be that coal that is making them sick in the first place. Sweet and Sour Productions made the film Coal Pushers Preview. At Bioenergy Lists, you can also watch other videos on building highly efficient rocket stoves out of simple materials, such as brick and bamboo.
We're going to cut this here and then bend this open.
What kind of a knife?
Machete would work fine.
Oh, okay.
You sharpen it good.
This video will show you how to build a tin can rocket stove, which was designed and demonstrated by Larry Winiarski at the Rotary International Integrated Cooking Workshop, Santiago Tlautla, Mexico, in July 2008. For this demonstration, we used a 5-gallon salad oil can to make the rocket stove. 8 4.5 by 9 inch thin facing bricks are used to make the chimney and the horizontal tunnel. To assemble the horizontal tunnel, you will have to cut 2 of the bricks into 4 and 5 inch pieces. Note the bricks stacked on either side of the horizontal tunnel to hold it in place while the tunnel and chimney are being assembled.
Okay. We're going to construct a stove with just adobe bricks. Adobe bricks have a lot of sawdust or shavings in them, and that makes the brick lighter and more insulating. It's a very inexpensive way to make a stove. We want to, as much as possible, to try to tie the bricks together. I'm not going to bother with mortar right now.
There are, of course, many humanitarian reasons to help people in developing countries burn fuel more safely and efficiently. For one thing, that will promote peace in the regions. But the UN has also cited the rate of deforestation in the Congo Basin as a major contributor to global warming. Deforestation contributes heavily to global warming, yet the problem was excluded from the Kyoto Protocol in 1997. According to an INN News report, deforestation is responsible for 1.6 billion tonnes of carbon emissions every year. That's 1/5 of the global total. It is also more than the combined total from the world's energy-intensive transport sectors, the U.S., U.K., China, Canada, Australia, and other places.
Okay, now we have a stove.
Dan Wolf, is Lifeline International a 501c3, a nonprofit?
That's correct. We, since we started, have strived to put as little money in the United States as possible and as much money into the areas in which we're working. Literally, until a year and a half ago, we did not have the Washington, D.C. office of our foundation was my home. Finally, that got to be a little bit too difficult. So now we have a small office that we rent for a small amount of money. And finally, I had to also hire a deputy to help manage my programs and direct them. One thing that I've learned painfully through this process is that I am not the best administrator in the world, and you do have to have a strong administrative and oversight system to have a program work well. So we've recently bolstered up our D.C. operation. I now have as an intern as well. But all of the employees, all of the money that our organization has is sent directly to the field and immediately goes to support the programs that we are operating. We have right now 3 international expatriate workers. We employ 20 local Ugandans on a full-time basis, and we have about 30 casual laborers and then another 40 micro-entrepreneurs.
So you're giving us the sense of how big your operation is. What are you up against in terms of the numbers of people who need these stoves, and how do you plan to expand and get more people the stoves?
Yeah, oh my God, you know, the numbers who cook with biomass, I believe, throughout the world is 75% of the human population. So we are making a small dent given the size of this issue. There are billions of people that we need to reach, and we are reaching hundreds of thousands right now. But the only way, really, in our view, to be able to deal with this in a short period of time and on a mass scale is to integrate this intervention into the marketplace, to essentially commercialize the product so that people will see the benefit and will purchase it in the same way that they purchase any other product. And we think that that's possible. So we see ourselves essentially as lighting a spark, as going into a community, doing advertising, creating a production center, encouraging other organizations, or not even organizations, but local entrepreneurs to mimic what we're doing and to make profit on what we're doing. And then we become obsolete and unnecessary, and we go into the next area. That's really the model that we need to use, and we can never distribute stoves to as many people as need them, but we can help to promote these local markets and in that way light a spark that will set a forest fire, in, as it were, of stoves throughout Africa and hopefully throughout the world. And I think that's doable, but it's a big project.
What can listeners do if they'd like to help with Lifeline? Is it a matter of you're needing donations? Is it a matter of you're needing, you know, participation? What kinds of people are you looking for help from, and how can listeners help?
Well, you know, all of the above, really. Of course, contributions help. This has been an effort that until recently I funded solely by myself, and now our budget is at the $500,000 a year level, and it's gone beyond my personal abilities to be able to sustain at that level. People can help in any number of ways. Certainly, we need to raise funds for the operation. Until now, I pretty much financed this all myself, but the budget is now up to about $500,000 a year, which is more than I can sustain on an annual basis. So people can donate by going onto our website, which is www.lifelinefund.org. In addition, people can raise awareness about this issue. They can talk to their elected representatives and try and get the issue of sustainable fuel technology onto the radar screen of policymakers in Washington, D.C. In addition, people can help by organizing local events, local fundraisers, or if people have the skills and the interest, they can ask to volunteer and come out to the field and help us there.
I want to ask, too, about the water drilling efforts that you've been involved with. Is that something you're still able to do?
Oh, absolutely. It is the other major project that we are involved with. Our concepts from the beginning was to do interventions that would have the greatest impact for the least cost. And probably there's no way you can do that better than providing clean water to a community that is drinking from stagnant pools and contaminated springs in which children are unable to attend school because they are plagued with dysentery, diarrhea, typhoid, intestinal worms, and so forth.
Is it the case that you're providing the well drilling equipment, the rig?
We have actually have two of our own rigs, which was obviously a substantial investment, vehicles to transport the rigs, and we take them out to remote villages in northern Uganda where, as I said, people are drinking from these stagnant pools, and we basically drill for water, and then we cap it, we put a pump on it, and all of a sudden people are drinking from filth. They're now drinking clean, fresh drinking water that you and I can drink safely. But it's more than that, actually. In a sense, that part of the project is quite easy. I mean, that's an exaggeration. It's not that easy. But it's the easy part. The hard part is actually getting people to change their habits because there are also substantial issues with improper sanitation, improper hygiene methods. And we have to devote a lot of attention to getting people to, for instance, wash properly the jerry cans into which they pour their water, have people properly wash their hands before eating, and so forth.
Now, when was the last time you were able to get into this region? I know you're talking about northern Uganda, the Somali border of Kenya, and the Burundi's border of Tanzania.
I personally go there two or three times a year, and in fact, I'm leaving on Friday for Uganda and Kenya.
What's on the horizon for the next 6 months, let's say? What are you most concerned with?
Well, one thing that's on the horizon is our first annual fundraiser, which will be in Washington, D.C. on September 24th. It'll be an art event slash fundraiser for the International Lifeline Fund. But out in the field, basically, we look to both expand and solidify our programs. On the Somali border of Kenya, we have recently redesigned the stove that we're using to make it more durable, and that new redesigned stove is going to go into distribution over the next several months, so that should be an exciting element. Second thing that we hope to do over the next 6 months is to pave the way, to do groundwork for the introduction of these wood-free stoves that we talked about, these pure biomass stoves that operate essentially on refuse and waste products. And we intend to expand our commercial network. We have right now two, basically, I guess you could call them two production centers or factories in northern Uganda. We plan to open a third one over the next 6 months. And finally, to expand our drilling activities, we have a second drilling rig that we're ready to put into operation. I guess the last thing that I would say is that people often have the feeling, and not without justification, that there's little that can be done to help the situation in Africa because tens of millions, hundreds of millions, literally billions of dollars have been put into efforts that just don't seem to reap the rewards. But if you target your interventions carefully, it is possible to make a tremendous impact in a way that you could never make in the United States. For instance, when we talk about the clean water projects, we are really talking about the cost of maybe $2 or $3 a person to bring clean water to a person's life who has been drinking from filth for years. And that's life-transforming, yet it's the same cost of what we would pay for a bottle of water for lunch. Similarly with a stove, which can cost as little as $2 or $3 each, we can transform somebody's life for almost nothing. So when you think about the net benefits of where money can go and what you can do with it, we can have a tremendous impact if we just are smart about how we spend our money.
Dan Wolf, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to an interview with Dan Wolf, founder of Lifeline International, lifelinefund.org. We heard the music of Echo Uganda, and then films from the bioenergylists.org page, including Making the Six Bricks Rocket Stove in Darfur with the International Lifeline Fund, created in 2006. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact Air Traffic Controller Ursula Rudenberg at Ursula, U-R-S-U-L-A, at Pacifica.org. I'm Dori Smith of Talk Nation Radio in Storrs, Connecticut. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.